Okay. So, good morning, guys. Today is going to be a little different. The idea, so first of all, I think our plan is actually going to be kind of similar to yesterday. Fyodor and I spoke, and there really is more of a совпадение between our two topics here than might be initially obvious from the syllabus. So I'm going to talk about some of the history, as you'll see behind me in a moment. As I say, this is an adaptation of a lecture that is usually my kind of background and opening lecture for a whole course on Eastern Europe, focusing largely on Ukraine, but not exclusively. I think Harrison may have some passing familiarity with this material. You helped me prepare this stuff, right? Yeah, that's right. That was a long time ago. And the idea of this, though, really is to zero in on a kind of cultural literacy in the issues of identity and memory politics that drive conflict in Eastern Europe. So that is largely but not exclusively about Russians and Ukrainians or Ukrainians and Poles and the kind of circularity of that whole set of relationships. And so what I want to do is highlight for you as we go through this, you know, what are the basic facts with which you really need to be conversant so as not to be, you know, deceived or not to be confused. That's what cultural literacy really is about on an issue like this. So that will be, I would say, much less geopolitical. Fyodor then is going to introduce a more geopolitical element in talking about some of the kind of integration aspirations of countries in the region, NATO membership, EU membership, et cetera. And then I think what we'll do is again, we'll do a joint discussion afterwards, if that's okay with you all. But if there are burning questions for clarification or just something that's very, very topical to what I'm saying, do feel free to interrupt me. I know sometimes I have a tendency to speak in full paragraphs. Maybe not. Maybe that's an overestimation, but don't. You can always add an ellipsis in there and interrupt me. Not a problem. So and then after all of that, we'll see how we do with time. After all of that, we'll give you an oral introduction to the simulation exercise for Friday, for which you should have already received a couple of documents by email. And we'll also assign you your roles today, I think. So, okay. Do I just press the button on here? That's okay. So, standard map of the region here in the background. What I'll do just very, very quickly is go over kind of the pre-modern origins of, roughly speaking, this part of the region, maybe even sort of this part down to both sides of the Black Sea, and then get into the slightly more relevant period of the last 500 years or so. So a term that you need to be conversant with is Scythians in English or Skifi in Russian and Ukrainian. These folks are famous mostly because of the artifacts that they left behind and because they are in many ways kind of the titular ancient culture of the Ukrainian steppe region. It's actually a Greek term originally for a Persian-speaking tribal network, so not specifically one group, but, you know, a whole bunch of groups, very common in the ancient world. They were known to the Persians themselves as the Sakas. They actually have no written records of their own, so the only way that we know about them are from the Greeks and the Persians. Most likely they were ethnically a Caucasian people who intermixed with Persians, but also with Mongol peoples and Europeans, and likewise, of course, with Slavs, who peopled the region at that time as well. Their presence was approximately the 8th century BC to sometime between the 4th and 7th centuries AD, by which time they had been largely displaced in the Black Sea region, at least by Turkic peoples, and or absorbed by Turkic peoples. So by the way, just so that I don't ever have to repeat it again, any notion of like racial purity in Eastern Europe is by definition an absurdity, right? Because the story of mixing and intermixing will just go on and on and on in every epic that I talk about. They're very famous for the so-called Kurgan burial mounds, which you can still find throughout the region. They left behind a lot of gold. Interestingly, none of the gold, so Scythian gold is quite famous. In fact, the Ukrainians commemorate it with these Ukrainian gold coins, named appropriately Scythian gold. But of course, the Scythians actually didn't make any of the gold themselves. It was all Greek gold that they basically acquired through trading and raiding. But then because they buried it in these burial mounds, lots of it has been discovered and it's been labeled as Scythian gold. Again, I introduce this stuff not because it's particularly important to understand identity politics, but because you need to be kind of culturally literate in these concepts in order to understand when a Ukrainian today makes a reference to, like, the, you know, original Ukrainians were the Scythians and tries to tell a story about continuity of civilization. You should know what that is. Herodotus talks about them as horse-born guerrilla warriors, and here you have, I believe, a Ripon painting from the 19th century of a battle between the Slavs and the Scythians. I'm presuming that this guy is the Slav and this guy is the Scythian, but again, it's this complete fantasy, so it really doesn't matter. It is a cool painting, though. All right. Many others in the region, of course, Greek colonies all throughout the northern Black Sea coast, Avars, Bulgars, Romans. Dacia was the Roman principality in the region of what is today Romania, but not just Romania. Goths, Byzantines, Khazars, a very unusual kingdom you may have heard about, which adopted a form of Judaism as its official religion between the 6th and the 11th centuries. So this was a region that was always seen by kind of the Western, what becomes Christendom later on, you know, sort of Roman Europe, as being Europe and yet somehow also beyond Europe. It is the wild, dangerous East. It is the wild steppe. So to ask a question like, who are the original people of Europe, is an inherently stupid question. Let's just get that out there. We will not be doing that, but we will be conversant with some of these names and concepts. All right, so we're going to jump right ahead to Kiev and Rus, right? This is by far the most important kind of locus of cultural literacy for Ukrainian identity today. Obviously, the term Kievan comes from the city of Kiev. I don't have to tell this group about the K-Y-I-V versus K-I-E-V spelling. Again, kind of a stupid debate. My position on this has always been, look, a country gets to decide how its capital city is going to be spelled. So if the Ukrainians say it's K-Y-I-V and pronounce it Kyiv, that's fine. It's fine with me. Totally cool with that. I very, very frequently have editors change that spelling back to K-I-E-V because it somehow is more of like an Anglophone British kind of thing to do in the English language. Again, it does have Russian connotations because that's how it's spelled in Russian, but really this is largely kind of a silly debate. Kiev, one of many alleged cities on seven hills, right? Just like Rome. If you go to Wikipedia, you'll find there's a list of like 50 cities around the world that claim to be on seven hills. In fact, for those who have spent time in Kiev, it is very hilly. There are at least seven hills. There are probably like 70 hills in Kiev, and none of them have particularly good sidewalks that are designed for strollers, I can tell you that much. The founding of the city is basically shrouded in myth. It maybe is something like a millennium and a half old. The mythology is that the two brothers and a sister, Kishek and Horiv, the three brothers, Kishek and Horiv, and the sister Libed, which are also the names of mountains in Kiev and a tributary of the Dnipro River, the Libed, were the mythological founders of the city around the 6th century, maybe as early as the late 5th century, and obviously this is all kind of fantastical, wonderful stuff. But you can kind of see if you've ever been to Kiev or if you kind of look at this picture, which is not wholly inaccurate in the way that it depicts the topography, why you would have put a city here, right? It's a bend in the Dnipro River. You have a big island there. You have heights. It's easily defensible. Obviously, fertile land. That's certainly well known about Ukraine. Later on, what is at that point still really more of a city-state kind of kingdom or principality comes to be ruled according to the Chronicle, which is the best record that we have of kind of early East Slavic life, by people known as the Varyagi or Varangians or Vikings. And these are folks who, so this is a little bit out of place. I apologize in my notes, but this is what eventually is the extent of Kievan Rus, right? So this is actually a pretty enormous empire. For a sense of scale, I don't have the image of it, but if you were to turn this thing on its side, it would more or less cover like all of modern Germany and France. So this is an enormous empire. So the Varyagi, the Vikings, are folks, you know, they're one line of Nordic raiders and traders who come down the river systems, there we go, of northern and eastern Europe, right? So there are all these wonderful rivers that they could basically take you, you can't quite sail down to the Black Sea because you have falls and other things to deal with, but they basically take you kind of deep into northern and eastern Europe. And so there's a lot of exposure of the Slavic tribes who live there and the others to the Vikings already. And this is where one of the early and important mythologies of identity and statehood in Eastern Europe begins. And this is the strange, at least to us in the West, notion of seeking a ruler from the outside. Because I remember as an American student when I first learned about this phenomenon, wait. So you're saying that the original kings of the Slavic tribes of Kievan Rus were Vikings from like hundreds of miles away? Like, yes. There are actually many later precedents in Russian and Ukrainian history for this notion of sort of reaching out to the outside, including the case of the boyars during the time of troubles in the early 17th century, actually writing a letter, believe it or not, to the King of England, Henry VIII, inviting him to come and rule over them. Now, lest you conceive of this as kind of like a uniquely East Slavic, Russian, Ukrainian desire to be ruled by someone else's iron hand. Those who have studied kind of the politics of elites during the Boyar period and during the Kievan Rus period will often tell you that no, in fact, these people were very clever about manipulating these kind of external actors so as to gain advantage for themselves. So it's very likely that it was a combination of those things, that you had, you know, powerful, fearsome Viking raiders who were coming down, were probably quite dominant, and one very good way of co-opting them was to say, hey, why don't you be our kings? And so instead of like burning and raping and pillaging, why don't you protect us? You know, kind of the way the mafia works. And then another side of the story probably also was that, you know, one faction within the local elites benefited from bringing in a powerful outsider and ousting the other faction. And anyway, the outsider didn't speak the language, didn't know what they were doing. And then the third element that's probably important is trade routes, right? Because the original inhabitants here were not particularly mobile, and the Varangians are quite mobile. And they, as I say, you know, unite this enormously large territory. So here's our buddy Rurik, or Roderick in sort of Germanic Scandinavian, the founder of the dynasty. And by the way, this is often kind of an entertaining little bit for anyone who hasn't thought of it before. There is actually a pretty surprising overlap between Scandinavian or Viking names you'd be familiar with, like Valdemar, Ingmar, Helga, or Helgi, with Slavic names that you may also be familiar with, right? Vladimir, Igor, Olga, Oleg, right? Okay, so after the death of this guy Rurik, the capital of Kievan Rus is moved to Kiev. The idea of Kiev as kind of the capital of Eastern Orthodoxy, which is really where the origin of Kievan Rus as the center of the Russian Eastern Orthodox world begins. That doesn't happen until about the turn of the millennium. So this guy called Vladimir comes to the throne, or Vladimir, in 980, and he converts to Orthodox Byzantine Christianity. There are all kinds of entertaining stories about how that happens, including the myth that he invites the emissaries of all the great world religions of the time. And, you know, he starts by asking the Muslim guy, and the Muslim, you know, Islam at that point is new, it's dynamic, it's, you know, conquered all of the known kind of Arabian world, and North Africa and Spain. And so he says, wow, you're really impressive. Tell me about your religion. I said, well, the first thing you need to know is we can't drink alcohol. He says, okay, done, moving on. And then, so then he asks the Jew and the, you know, he said, we got the Khazars there and you're very ancient and very learned and all this stuff. That's great. Tell me about your religion. Well, he says, you know, can you drink alcohol? He goes, absolutely no problem with alcohol. But we don't eat pigs. He says, okay, moving on. And then he asks the Catholic, you see where this is going, right? No meat and fasting. And he finally gets to the Eastern Orthodox guys. So the priests can marry. You can eat whatever you want most of the time. And we got no problem with alcohol. Come on in. Obviously, that's a myth. In fact, what likely happened was that during a period of retrenchment of the Eastern Roman Empire, which is, of course, Byzantium, a deal is struck with the warriors of Kiev, of the Rus, to come and support them against their enemies. And in the context of that, basically, a Rus army ends up at the gates of Constantinople. And the way that this situation is resolved is that Volodymyr marries the sister of the Byzantine Emperor Basil II, Anna. And most likely, they were fighting the Greeks, although it's not totally clear, because of course they sort of were also Greeks. And the story is then that Volodymyr is baptized in Crimea, right? This becomes very significant later on at Chersonesus in 988. And that is a date that you need to know, 988, the baptism of the Rus. Although if you use that term, I have learned this, you will get in trouble. If you write the baptism of the Rus, you should just say the baptism of Volodymyr, because there are all kinds of people out there in the internet who have theories about when this in fact happened. And by the way, like most conversions, in that time, it really had no effect whatsoever on people practicing, pagan ancestor worship, worshiping Norse gods or gods who were very similar to Norse gods, these sort of wooden carved statues. This continued for hundreds of years. But of course, the elite led by Volodymyr converts in basically the turn of the millennium, 988. His grandson, this guy, Yaroslav the Wise, builds this beautiful cathedral. This is actually what you see behind you, is a reconstruction, which is actually being reconstructed again in that photo. So it's not quite how the original looked, although it's obviously similar and it's quite beautiful. In 1037, and this becomes kind of the symbol of Kiev. And not long afterwards, the empire is essentially already crumbling into little feuding statelets. All right, so this is, in a super, super broad brush way, the main things you need to know about Kiev and Rus. Then we have the Mongol period. Important for many, many reasons, but again, being very superficial here. The Rus chronicler of the time writes, when Batu Khan in the year 1240 sweeps through the southern Rus kingdom and lays waste to everything, including the city of Kiev, he writes, "For our sins, unknown nations arrived. No one knew their origin or whence they came or what religion they practiced. That is known only to God and perhaps to wise men learned in books." And of course, you know, the great innovation that allowed the Mongols to triumph was what? Any horse riding people in the audience here?
Stirrup.
The stirrup, right, because you can actually aim a bow while you're riding if you're standing on something. Yeah, so the stirrup results in the collapse of essentially southern Slavdom at that time. And so by the year 1300, the metropolitan, who is the leader of the Eastern Orthodox Church in Kiev, departs for parts unknown, the wilds of the north, the forested regions of Vladimir and Suzdal, Novgorod, and eventually Moscow. Here you get kind of a sense of roughly where the dividing line is. So basically, if you think about the steppe as running from the depths of Eurasia, from Mongolia itself across what is today the Central Asian Stan Republics, all the way across the Caspian region, and here into southern Ukraine, This was all territory that was directly conquered and sort of owned by descendants of the Great Khan. And by the way, the Mongol Empire still ranks as the largest empire in the history of humanity. Kind of amazing. When you go to Mongolia today and there are like 3 million people there and they're super peaceful. And they have, you know, the joke about the Mongolian army that they told me when I was there is, you know, so the president and the general are watching field exercises and the president says, this is very impressive. Send all of the tanks to the border. You know, like, let's go conquer our neighbors. And the general says, sir, are you sure? We haven't waged war for 1,000 years. I think we might be out of it. He said, no, send all of the tanks right now. All of them, sir? Yes, all of them. Both of them, sir? Mongolia is not much of a military power today. So the difference up here, of course, is largely driven by topography. The fact that it's densely forested, how do you ride horse-borne, you know, arrow-shooting warriors through dense forests? You sort of don't. But nonetheless, as the map indicates, it's a vassal kingdom. And even to this day, some of you may have seen, you have the Zolotoya Orda street in Moscow, right, which was, again, theoretically, the route that would lead to the encampment of the Khan's representative outside of Moscow, where you would ride to pay tribute to him so that he didn't ride into Moscow and lay waste to the city. By the end of the 15th century, the Golden Horde, which is this sort of westernmost component of the former Mongol Empire, don't forget, at the same time, the Mongols also controlled China, which is at that time sort of a much bigger prize than these primitive people in the West. So the Golden Horde collapses by the end of the 15th century, resulting in, you know, just think of the sort of the tide pulling out, and what's left behind is a completely changed balance between what had been a sort of East Slavic, you know, ethnos and East Slavic civilization dominated by the South, to now one dominated by the North. This is really the moment for Muscovy and what we think of as Russia, what later becomes Russia and the Russian Empire. Okay, one more political administrative concept to introduce, and that's the Grand Duchy or the Kingdom of Poland and Lithuania. This is certainly relevant for Ukraine. It's also especially relevant for Belarus and even for Russia. The Lithuanians, again, you know, today a relatively small people, relatively limited in their ambitions. They are Europe's last practicing pagans. They're still pagans in the 16th century. They are fierce warriors. They conquer an enormous region, including a big chunk of southern and eastern Slavdom. And from roughly the late 14th century to the mid 1600s, this territory, much of Ukraine today, all of Belarus, a big chunk of Poland, is ruled from Krakow. Now, Krakow, if you've ever seen it, is a city in southern Poland. It's very, today at least, a very Central European looking, probably the classic Central European city. This is another one of these citations for today's modern Eastern Europeans who sort of, despite their Soviet past, which we'll talk about in a moment, they point to their origins in the Kingdom of Poland, Lithuania, being ruled out of Krakow, and they say, look, we're so obviously Europeans. Again, I tend to think this is one of those stupid debates. It's like I said yesterday, there's no reason why you can't be European and Russian, European and Ukrainian, whatever it may be. But this fact of having been ruled from Krakow, which is this sort of quintessentially European city, is very important. It was a very pluralistic state. You had an elite that spoke multiple languages. It was said that the court language of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was Belarusian, was closest to today's Belarusian, but you had, of course, Poles, Jews, Tatars, Ruthenians, all sorts of folks. Even the so-called nobility, the Szlachta, which was quite large, about 10% of the society, was also pluralistic. You had all sorts of ethnic minorities represented in it. And it was in the context of the Poland-Lithuanian Commonwealth that the Greek Catholic or Uniate Church is created, which becomes important later on in Ukraine, and that's at the end of the 16th century. Okay, oops, there's another map. Cossacks. who knows anything about Cossacks? You ever heard the term Cossacks? Cossack seems to be just bandied about, used for pretty much anything. Nowadays, you have Cossack communities in the Russian Far East. You have Cossacks, of course, in Ukraine. You have, arch Russian nationalist Cossacks fighting the Ukrainians. And the thing about Cossacks is what it meant 400 or 500 years ago, or even 200 years ago, is quite radically different than what it means today. Today, of course, it's a political instrument. We'll talk more about that. But it is legitimately more of an ethnic group today than it was then. At that time, it was a catch-all category. And the term that I like best for this is Ruthenian cowboys. So basically, Cossacks are people who choose to live outside the law. Whatever their ethnic or national background is, they are people who decide that they do not want to live under the thumb of any one of these particular states or principalities. By definition, they therefore tend to need to do a lot of fighting. That's how you protect your independence. They are used as shock troops and frontier guards by Poland-Lithuania against the Tatars. Later on, they're also used by the Russians for this purpose. And they tended to have a slightly more democratic leaning system of governance, which again is what you would expect if you put together a bunch of sort of, think of these as runaways, right? Circus runaways, runaway cowboys, people who want to get outside the law, so they don't tend to like, authoritarian hierarchical structure. So they would elect through a kind of council called a sich, they would elect a guy called a hetman. Kind of sounds like headman, right? Okay, that's a good way to remember it, as their leader. But really, they never had, it would not be correct, and this is very important because it becomes a debate in modern Ukraine as to the kind of statehood continuity of Ukraine. It would not be correct to say that there was a Cossack state. There never was such a thing as a Cossack state. There was a kind of Cossack way of life. It was widespread across a certain territory, but it never came close to encompassing all Ukrainians or even being interchangeable with Ukrainianness. There were always people who were Ukrainians, whatever they call themselves, who were not Cossacks. The most famous moment here, and this is another name and a date that you need to know, is the 1648 uprising of the Cossacks, led by Bogdan Khmelnytsky. He was a Cossack hetman. He is seen by many as a sort of William Wallace figure, right? Braveheart. He's a complicated dude. Interestingly, a monument to him is built by the Soviets in Kiev, still stands to this day on Sofievska Square. But then, as you can see depicted down here, some nasty stuff happened. I think the thing for which he was most infamous was slicing open the bellies of pregnant women, pulling out the babies and sewing live cats inside. So not necessarily a great hero figure. His rebellion against the Polish-Lithuanian overlords does not go well. And so in 1651, he turns to Moscow for help. This results in another name and date that you should know, 1654, the Treaty of Pereyaslav. And who knows what happened, Pereyaslav? Well, yeah, or allegiance, at least, to the Romanov Tsars of Russia. At that time, it's Alexei Mikhailovich, who's the second Romanov Tsar, I believe. The idea is basically that the Cossacks will fight as the frontier shock troops of the Russians against this Polish threat, which is a very real threat at the time, if you think about the time of troubles that had happened just 50 years before. But then, barely two decades later, the Poles and the Russians sign the first of several eternal peace agreements and basically throw the Cossacks under the bus. So they're from the very beginning, even from this sort of famous moment, which is, sort of... This, by the way, is the Zaporizhian Cossacks. Again, I think it's a Repin painting, right? I think they're writing a letter to the Tsar, you know, something.
They're writing letter to Turkish Sultan.
To the Turkish Sultan, that's what it is, yeah. You know, even from the moment of this sort of, there's another painting I guess I don't have in here of Pereyaslav, right, of this kind of declaration of loyalty. But and that moment has been so much mythologized, but you have to remember that even from that moment, there was enormous kind of distrust and cynicism between the sides, but also a complex, unclear identity as to who was whom, right? Because a Russian could very easily go and be a Cossack. It was a lifestyle choice at that time, rather than an ethnicity. Okay. Yes, absolutely.
When did that Good. Dynamic change between becoming...
Great. So I'm actually about to get to that, but thank you for asking. Yeah. I promise I will get to that. And if I don't get it to your satisfaction, interrupt me. All right. Another guy you got to know about, I'm just going chronologically here. This guy called Ivan Mazepa. I love this painting too, because in this one he's depicted, you know, that character Grima Wormtongue in Lord of the Rings, the guy who kind of whispers in the ear of the King of Rohan. Right, so he kind of has that quality to him, and so he, for Russians at least, is a much more controversial figure than Khmelnytsky, because he sort of did a lot of changing of loyalties. Originally, he was kind of a semi-Polish nobleman. Then he becomes hetman, allegedly through trickery. Then he betrays Peter the Great, you know, violates the Pereyaslav agreement and joins up with Charles the XII of Sweden. This is back at a time when Sweden is a major military power. Something else that when I first learned this like 20 years ago, I was like, what, Sweden? You know, there's all these countries, right, that are like tiny, peaceful countries today that everybody thinks has like great social welfare and they're so wonderful, and they were like enormous empires. So Sweden is threatening Russia at the time, and Ivan Mazepa offers his Cossacks to come to the aid of Charles the XII, and famously, of course, at Poltava in Ukraine in 1709, they are defeated. And by the way, you know where Mazepa ends up? He ends up, he runs away and ends up in the city of Bendery, which is today the westernmost outpost of Transnistria. It's a little sort of pimple that's on the Moldovan side of the Dniester River. You can actually visit the fortress that ostensibly Mazepa lived in at that time, and there are cannons very significantly pointed east, even though the city and the fortress are controlled by Transnistria, which is pro-Eastern, pro-Russian. Anyway, I just love this stuff. I stand in front of that cannon for hours and just like feel very excited about history. So Mazepa is kind of a classic example of a sense to Russians of betrayal by the Ukrainians, by the Cossacks. Even though, as I've said, the two terms are not interchangeable, but Mazepa is a hero to those who like the notion of breaking ties with Russia. He is a villain to those who like the notion of brotherhood. After this betrayal and the defeat of Charles the XII, the Cossacks come under direct Russian command, or at least to those that are, you know, within the territorial sway of the Russian army. Many of them are deported then by Catherine to the Caucasus to fight in the wars against the Turks. Cossack nobles, so kind of elite, you know, relatively bigger bosses within Cossack land, are given Russian noble status. Remember, of course, Peter the Great has an elaborate table of ranks, so it's relatively easy to assign people ranks and give them estates and so forth. When Russia absorbs Eastern Poland through the series of 18th century partitions, it then acquires Western Ukraine, or what is now Western Ukraine, and conquers Crimea from the Tatars around the same time, repopulating it largely with migrants from all over this territory, which is known as New Russia, or as you may have heard, Novorossiya, right? It's a term that's back in vogue, along with another term that as of the last 24 hours is back in vogue. I don't know if you read Malorossiya, Little Russia. The separatists in Donbass have declared themselves now not to be two separate states, but actually the new state of Little Russia. And guess whose flag they're using? Bogdan Khmelnytsky. That is amazing. They have gone back to one of, so lest you think that I am boring you with a bunch of like dry, irrelevant ancient history, there are reasons that I am naming the names that I'm naming. It's about cultural literacy for stuff like this that happens today. And by the way, I guarantee you 99.9% of Western political officials who receive some type of news or intelligence briefing that this has happened have no idea what the historical significance or resonance of that declaration is. Their banner, I wish I had a picture. I prepared these slides more than 24 hours ago, but it is like an ancient banner. It's not a flag shape. It's like this, like, you know, warrior banner thing. And it's got like old Cyrillic writing, and it's Bogdan Khmelnytsky's battle flag. It's amazing. It's like if you brought back like a Confederate stars and bars, which was not even, by the way, the flag of the Confederacy. It was a battle flag. Anyway, okay, you see, I get very excited about this stuff. Okay, in the 19th century, Russian officials basically deny that there is such a thing as a Ukrainian nation. It is incorporated as Malorossiya, Little Russia. The 1876 Edict of Ems. Ems, by the way, is a resort in Germany where the Tsar is just chilling out at the time. He takes 5 minutes off from his mud baths or whatever to declare that there is no such thing as a Ukrainian language, and essentially therefore outlaw the Ukrainian language. Ukrainian elites are to the maximum extent possible co-opted and Russified. And then after the assassination of Alexander II in 1881, any tolerance for ethnic nationalism is basically gone. And so these people who have only been part of the Russian Empire for about 100 years, they are really chafing under, you know, laws and rules that say basically you don't exist. So you're exactly the same as everybody else in Russia. So there's this guy called Taras Shevchenko, which if you haven't heard of him, you haven't been paying attention. He has an amazing story. So he's born as a serf. His master, presumably a Russian-Ukrainian nobleman, brings him to the imperial capital, to St. Petersburg, where he then liberates him, remarks upon and supports his artistic talent, his talent as an author and a poet. And he becomes kind of a cause celeb. This is a very... It's a unique phenomenon, and yet it's one that I think we understand pretty well in our own modern-day empire, which is, despite the relatively chauvinistic feelings of people throughout, you know, the Russian Empire at the time, or, say, the United States now, in the salons, the elite kind of intellectual, you might even say sort of... what's the word the Soviets always used to denigrate the West? I forgot. Anyway, it's cosmopolitan, whatever, salons of the imperial capital. It was like an entertainment to bring out this little Russian, this Ukrainian poet, and to have him, you know, read his Ukrainian poetry, even though a lot of that poetry was viciously anti-Russian. That is the fascinating thing. He sat in the very heart of the capital of the Russian Empire in salons that you could have read about from Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, like, you know, counts and dukes and their wives and so on, spouting his Ukrainian nationalism. What a strange moment of historical irony. And so in part, I posit his acceptability, and again, this is another monument built in Soviet times. There are many such monuments, and of course, many things named after him. His acceptability to Russian and Soviet authorities has something to do with his origins, in fact, in the heart of empire, and not so much from, for instance, Galicia, from Western Ukraine, which we'll talk about in a moment when we talk about other versions of Ukrainian nationalism. And yet, I want to make sure to read you one of his poems. You'll see he doesn't pull any punches. These are quite viciously anti-Russian verses. And by the way, there is a monument to him, not this one, obviously, but there is a monument to him in Washington, D.C. If you ever have a chance, it's a couple blocks off of DuPont Circle at 22nd and P. Do I have a photo? I have a photo of it. That's it. And it was built in, I believe, in the 1960s. June 27th, 1964. And if you read the language in this, it's really wonderful. And this is actually, I tend in my class, I skip over this, but for our purposes, it's very important. This monument of Taras Shevchenko, 19th century Ukrainian poet, dedicated to the liberation and freedom and independence of all captive nations, right? That's an incredibly important element of the Cold War narrative. That, you know, it's the Russians who are dominating all of these other peoples in the Soviet Union, that there's no Ukrainian involvement in creating the Soviet Union, it's all Russians. That's sort of an enormous irony, by the way, in 1964, because who's the boss of the Soviet Union? Khrushchev, right? And where's he from? Donetsk, right? Okay, so fighter for independence of Ukraine, the freedom of all mankind. Right, so he's now like this Jeffersonian figure who, under foreign Russian imperialist tyranny, that's an amazing set of adjectives, and colonial rule, appealed for the new and righteous law of Washington, was unveiled, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so this is paid for by the American taxpayer, authorized by the U.S. Congress, and plunked down in the center of Washington, D.C. in the 1960s. Again, 99.9% of Americans do not have a clue what this statue is, okay? To be fair, probably 95% can't identify the statue of Gandhi that's a block away, but still incredibly significant. This stuff is being done, you know, for and on behalf of the people of the United States, with enormous resonance, obviously, for Russians, for the Soviet Union at the time, and most people don't have a clue what it means. Okay. Now Galicia. You all know what Galicia is, I assume. I don't have to give you the absolute basics here. Great. So, you know, you see it's this region that kind of spans what is today Poland and Ukraine from the mid-19th century onward. So it's under the Habsburg Empire for the entire relevant period here that we're talking about, basically until World War II. The vast bulk of this territory is never in the Russian Empire and never in the Soviet Union until after World War II. And so in the 19th century, as the Habsburg Empire is facing a series of internal and external threats, the authorities in Vienna essentially make the decision that it is the less scary threat is from Ukrainian nationalism versus from this growing power of Russia in the East. And so they kind of use and cultivate and foment a whole school of, you know, very aggressively anti-Russian Ukrainian nationalist thought. History, political parties, including, ironically, socialist political parties, all of which are being sponsored and supported by the Austrian Habsburg leadership as an instrument for resisting. You could think of these folks as essentially their shock troops against the East as a way of resisting Russian influence. And the most famous name here, Mikhailo Khrushchevsky, who is thought of as the father of Ukrainian history, who worked at Lviv University. And of course, Lviv is the capital of Galicia. There are actually several oblasts today which are more or less associated with Galicia, but the main one is called Khalichina in Ukrainian. And Lviv, as you can see, you know, another like very classically Central European city, absolutely beautiful city, by the way, but which only comes under Moscow's control after the Second World War. And as a result, again, these are people who really chafe under the notion that they are somehow brothers or owe fealty to the Russians, and have always felt that way and feel that way to this day, which is kind of the origin of this story of Ukraine, where it's, you know, divided roughly along the Dnipro River between people who feel like they don't want to have anything to do with the East and people who feel like they're kind of also part of Russia. That's a radical oversimplification. All right. I think in the interest of time, I'm not going to do Romania, Moldova right now. Okay, just a little bit about the Soviet period and how this resonates today. In 1917 and 18, following the Russian Revolution, there are various declarations of independence in Ukraine and Belarus, in all parts of this borderland region, including a declaration of a Ukrainian People's Republic, a West Ukrainian People's Republic, both of which are allied with the Central Powers against the Eastern Ukrainian Bolshevik Republics. There's a Belarus National Republic in 1918. There's even a very short-lived Hetmanate, which is created under German sponsorship in 1918. Under the Tsarist general Pavlo Skoropadsky. And then when the Germans are defeated in the West, later in the year, this Ukrainian republic falls apart. The red and the white armies cross back and forth fighting each other across Ukraine. You have many of the kind of scattered leftover troops from the Central Powers, Germans, Austrians, as well as Russian whites who are fighting under Denikin. You have a Polish army. There's even a Polish-Ukrainian war where they're fighting over Galicia in 1919. So you get the sense this is pretty much anarchy. I mean, it's, you know, this is not a happy place to be in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution. You have anarchists under Makhno, and then in 1920, the Poles and the Western Ukrainians patch up their differences and join together to fight the Soviets. This is a deal between the famous Pilsudski and Simon Petlura, who is the leader of the Ukrainian forces. In 1921, the Poles and the Soviet Union basically divide up Ukraine and sign a border treaty, and you can see, oops, there, you can see the result of that. So the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic is, you know, a good 70% of what it later becomes after World War II, but it does not include these three key Western Ukrainian kind of Galician oblast. It does not include what later becomes a Republic of Moldova. And by the way, this is a very interesting factoid about why we have the Transnistria conflict today, that Stalin quite intentionally insists that there be this little entity called the Moldovan ASSR. And the reason for that is to preserve a theoretical claim on the Russian imperial territory that was called Bessarabia. Because in fact, Bessarabia did include some parts that were to the east of the River Dniester. The result of this, though, is that you essentially have this little piece of territory that for every other purpose is basically, you know, part of the Soviet Union for 30 years longer than this chunk of territory, which is part of Romania for those same 30 years. And that division now, still only one human lifetime later, right? Because we're talking about the 1930s up to the 1940s, in fact. It's not till 44 that this territory is liberated and then retaken by the Soviets. So there are still to this day people living here who remember, you know, being part of Greater Romania, and that was an important thing to them. So in terms of identity politics in Moldova, which is not going to be a big focus of ours, this is really where that problem has its origins. I want to go back for a second, too. This is Polish anti-Bolshevik propaganda. What do you notice about these posters, by the way? How do the Bolsheviks look? Any particular ethnos being represented there? Yeah. These are definitely being depicted as Jews. Yeah, kind of, right? Yeah. I mean, it definitely looks, yeah. But I mean, this one's a classic, right? This could be taken straight out of, you know, later Nazi propaganda. So the idea of kind of an ethnic dimension to this political struggle in the aftermath of the Russian Revolution is there from the very beginning. And this is, of course, something that Hitler exploits massively later on with the idea of fighting the Jewish Bolsheviks, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So in this territory, of course, the Russians are great with their own propaganda, too. In this territory that is then controlled by the Soviet Union, there sort of is a series of tragedies that unfold, all of which become, you know, kind of deeply resonant in the collective Ukrainian consciousness of what does it mean to be ruled by Moscow? Well, here's what it means. The kulaks, they must be eliminated. What is a kulak? a wealthy peasant. How do you define a wealthy peasant? A peasant who has two cows instead of one cow, right? A peasant whose roof doesn't leak. I mean, the de-kulakization campaign for a territory like Ukraine, which is an agricultural society where everyone's dream is to have two cows, or ideally more than that, is a complete disaster, right? So you have all manner of people being rounded up from the very beginning of this de-kulakization campaign, 1929 to 1930 is the most intense period of it, including, of course, people who had the misfortune to have fought with the White Army or the Russian Imperial Army. People who are just turned in by their neighbors because their neighbors want something from them. And if you read Tim Snyder, this is actually a really, I think, good point that he makes, that this is a moment where the precedent is set that you can gain by turning against your neighbor, right, with this first de-kulakization campaign. Then, of course, you have the famine, the Holodomor. This is something that... Sorry, that's obviously not what I was trying to get at with Holodomor. You know, Holodomor is something that is deeply resonant with Ukrainians today. Russians are not really in the habit of denying that it occurred. The debate tends to be about intention, whether the element of genocide, of intending to obliterate a people, as a people, was present in Holodomor. The Russian narrative tends to be more, look, we were collectivizing agriculture across the Soviet Union. This applied to Russia, Kazakhstan, and also Ukraine. You know, we were mechanizing, look at these happy farmers. And in fact, there were a lot of technological, economic, and social benefits to the arrival of Soviet power. In fact, many people who, like women, right, who had been, you know, under the thumb of patriarchal dominance, were really liberated to do things like drive a tractor or work in a factory. But in fact, the human cost of this was enormous. The numbers are also hotly debated, but we are probably talking about well over a million people. And you know, my feeling about this, Vasily Grossman in Forever Flowing says, you know, he compares it explicitly to the Holocaust, and he says, what it adds up to is that Stalin intentionally, deliberately killed people by starvation. And I think that's essentially the point, right? Whether you were intending to eliminate Ukrainians as an ethnos, that might be a particular conceit of today's Ukrainian national narrative, fine. But if you were intending to murder people through starvation, this is like a heinous act, you know, on the level of other such terrible acts. So this is sort of number two, and the hits keep coming, because then you have the Great Terror, right, which also takes place across the Soviet Union, 1937 to 38. About 250,000 Ukrainians are arrested. More than 100,000 of them are killed. Of 62 members of the Central Committee of Ukraine's Communist Party, 55 of them are killed in the Great Terror. And then, of course, this is followed by World War II and the Holocaust. Here you have Babi Yar. You guys have heard about Babi Yar, right? This killing pit outside of Kiev, where at least 30,000 Jews were killed just in September 1941, in sort of the opening moments of the war. Later on, Soviet POWs, Ukrainian nationalists, and others are executed there as well. As Tim Snyder writes, the Holocaust in Ukraine was a death by bullets more than by gas chambers. But then you also have the story of resistance. Fascinating stories, very much a part of kind of the mythology of who the Soviet people were. It's a moment of relative unity among Soviet people, although interestingly, you also have nationalist resistance groups, right? So you have, you know, Poland, the sort of archetype. Poland is an interesting comparison point for all of this stuff. And the reason is because as a result of World War II, Poland started out as incredibly ethnically pluralistic. Remember the Kingdom of Poland and Lithuania, right? It's like super pluralistic. By the end of World War II, and as a result of the Allied movement of borders and redistribution of people, Poland is 99% Polish and Catholic. So it becomes one of the most ethnically pure states in Eastern Europe, and therefore is a very interesting comparison point for all of this stuff. So Poland's narrative about the role of the Armia Krajowa, the territorial resistance army of the Poles, which continues to fight the Nazis and as well as the Soviets later on after the Polish army officially surrenders, it's a very clean narrative, right? We have a Polish government in exile hanging out in London. We have Polish units fighting with the British and the American army, and we have the Armia Krajowa fighting in Poland. Nowhere near so clean in Ukraine or in Belarus, where you have, for example, the UPA, the Ukrainska Powstańska Armia, which is the sort of their version of this, but it's not supported by what had previously been the government in Kiev, because that was a Soviet government. And this is a Ukrainian nationalist army. And they are explicitly ethnic, although amazingly, if you go talk to some of their latter-day representatives in Kiev today, like Pravi Sektor, they will tell you this crazy stories about, oh, no, there were Russians and there were Jews in the UPA, which is insane. Of course, there were not. And, you know, these people were happily, busily killing Germans, but also Russians, Jews, Poles. In particular, the massacre to know about is in Volynia, in northwestern Ukraine. If I had a map here. Yeah, so this area up here is called Volynia, and one of the really fascinating things today is if you want to find Western Ukrainian, so it's like Ukrainian-speaking, you know, not part of the Soviet Union until 1945, but who utterly despise the legacy of Ukrainian nationalism, go to Lutsk in Volynia. Like, that's where you'll find these folks. And so there's an interesting kind of political alliance that emerges between people from here and people from here, you know, the Donbass folks who are much more kind of Russia-oriented to begin with. And it's because they both hate people from here, the kind of Galician UPA, OON folks. And of course, the names to know from this time period are Bandera, which, again, if you don't know, you haven't been paying attention, great, you know who he is, and Roman Shukhevich, who was actually the leader of the UPA. Bandera was the leader of a sort of smaller, more radical element of the Union of Ukrainian Nationalists called the OUN-B, B for Bandera. And Bandera continued to fight until long after the war. He fought for years after 1945 and was eventually captured and executed. You have the story of collaboration. This is huge. This is actually what I did my undergraduate thesis research on. There was, in fact, an SS division raised from Galicia, called appropriately SS Galicia. Kind of hard to escape that legacy. Very significant today. And then on the Soviet side, you have kind of the narrative of Kiev as the hero city, having survived the war. Ukrainian troops, of course, and troops who fought in Ukraine and fought all the way through Ukraine to get to Berlin. Their graffiti here is preserved inside the Reichstag building. Have any of you seen this? It's really cool, powerful to see that. Belts, by the way, is it's in the northern part of Moldova. There was a huge campaign there. It's one of the more pro-Russian bastions in Moldova today. Okay, so I think, yeah. Just very, very quickly on the later Soviet period, very quickly, and then we'll wrap up, and I really hope we can get into a lot more of this in discussion. Oh, and I have to read my poem to you. Like, the story of Chernobyl is well known, but what it meant to a lot of Ukrainians and to Belarusians was kind of, it revealed the ultimate lie, the ultimate dishonesty of the Soviet leadership. So they were telling a story about how they had, you know, brought technology and industrialization and prosperity to these, you know, benighted agrarian people. But look, in fact, at what they had done. They didn't care. that this event occurs and the cloud of radioactivity settles on Kiev, you know, blows up towards Minsk, you know, right in time for the May Day parades on May 1st, and they don't even bother to tell the hundreds of thousands of families and people who are going out in the streets that they have lethal doses of radioactivity settling down upon them. And so this is one of those breakthrough moments for the whole Soviet Union, but in particular for Ukraine and Belarus, which are directly affected by this, where they simply say this system cannot stand, and we cannot be ruled from Moscow. There you can see the map of the fallout, so you can see it affects Belarus actually more than it does Ukraine, but Ukraine quite significantly. And by the way, I mean, that's Kiev right there, so definitely heavy radioactivity over Kiev. You know, the Soviet experience is remembered in a complex and mixed way, as would not be surprising to you. I mean, here, you know, the sort of caricatures of, you know, of Ukraine from Kyivskaya Metro, sort of, you know, being depicted, flowers and beautiful, healthy, robust people, and the vision of Belarus as kind of the noble partisan republic. And then, of course, this is from Tiraspol, from Transnistria, where it used to be, it's changing a little now, but it used to be kind of a Soviet theme park. If you want to see what Brezhnev's Soviet Union looked like, go to Tiraspol. It's like completely unchanged. And then, of course, there is a reality to the fact that, like, for example, the Ukrainian embassy had a brilliant idea about 6 months ago to do an exposition in the Ronald Reagan building where I work, federal building, of Ukraine's contributions to global science and technology. And so they had all these posters. And what was weird about it to me was that like 90% of those contributions were either explicitly done by sort of Soviet Ukrainians in the context of Soviet research institutions and the Soviet military industrial complex, or they were done by Ukrainian emigres, most of whom were Jews, working in the West, who left because they were not happy in Ukraine. And the fact that the Ukrainian embassy acknowledges the substantive contributions, which are incredibly important for Ukraine, but without at all coming to grips with the complex identities that are entailed in these things, tells you what the problem is today. And that's kind of where we're left. And I love to just sort of show this image because, you know, it's... This is kind of like the cycle of building and decay of modern Ukraine, right? So you have the various eras of socialist architecture, you know, more and more and more people getting housing, but housing getting crappier and crappier. And so when you end up here and you look back at this, you know, I don't know, maybe you kind of want to go back about 100 years because things sort of look a lot better than this. Almost kind of a joke. And then, of course, I've mentioned this, you know, the Soviet elite had an awful lot of Ukrainians in it. Let me end with these lines, because I promised them, from Shevchenko, about what is the essence of, what is the basis and the essence of Ukrainian identity today? Is it inclusive? Can it be inclusive? What is its relationship to the other ethnic groups in and around Ukraine? I'll just leave you with this poem and let you think about it and hand the floor to Fyodor. This is by Taras Shevchenko. Here and there they carry on, in Russian laugh and curse. Their parents who'd not had them taught to jabber while still children, the German language, so that now they would not be ink-pickled. Leeches, leeches, for maybe your father had to sell his last cow to the Jews till he could teach you Russian well. So, national hero of Ukraine.